Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. And from Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
While local governments are fighting to hang on to their rulemaking authority, Florida's outgoing House Speaker argues preemption is precisely what the Founding Fathers had in mind.
And they basically said that the federal government exists with these enumerated powers. What's not enumerated, all of it belongs to the state.
Also this week, the League of Women Voters claims a constitutional amendment on this November's ballot doesn't mean what it says when it comes to approving charter schools.
Who can then establish schools? Well, that's the $64,000 question.
We'll also hear how the debate over a new Supreme Court justice is playing out in Florida and get the latest on the new algae blooms taking over parts of Lake Okeechobee and what might be done about it. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. Florida's local governments are continuing their battle to hang on to home rule. Regan McCarthy reports that fight is centering around a court case battling a law that largely preempts local ordinances on firearms.
Every year, Florida lawmakers pass legislation that takes away a local government's ability to make its own rules on specific issues. The state has preempted what's known as home rule on issues spanning from the use of plastic bags to the law in question. Outgoing House Speaker Richard Corcoran has said he thinks preemption is what the Founding Fathers had in mind when they created the U.S. Constitution.
I think our founders got it right. When they set up a constitution, they basically said that the federal government exists with these enumerated powers. What's not enumerated, all of it belongs to the states, every bit of it. And the states have all of that.
On the other hand, Gil Ziffer, Tallahassee City Commissioner and President of the Florida League of Cities, argues home rule is essential to governing. He says giving local leaders the ability to make decisions for their local residents helps maintain the community's sense of place.
Not all cities are created the same. They're different, and that's why people move to different areas. We want to be able to maintain that individuality, and the only way to do that, whether you want to call it home rule or local control or whatever, you know, two words, three words you want to put together. But it's democracy at its very basic level, which is on a local level. And that's what we need to maintain. And sometimes some leadership, particularly on the House side, is coming after us to remove that ability. And we're going to fight it.
And Brian DeLoge, a former president of the National Association of Counties and currently on County Commissioner, agrees. He says home rule has come under siege recently.
There's a balance between the state and the federal and local government, and frankly, home rule should be where it ends. We're the people that understand the needs in the communities, and we get voted in or out based on the job we do.
DeLoge says he's pushing back against the state's firearm preemption legislation, not because of the subject matter, but because it's what he calls a gross overreach. The legislation comes with penalties for local government leaders who try to impose firearm rules more stringent than those in state law.
The way it read to us was you will be removed from office, you will be personally fined $5,000, you cannot use your county attorney as your representative.
The number of local governments joining the challenge against the law is mounting, with Leon County officials voting in their most recent meeting to join the case. The suit alleges the 2011 law is unconstitutional because of the penalties tied to the statute. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
The League of Women Voters of Florida is suing to block a constitutional amendment that could pave the way for more charter schools. The League says the ballot summary, which voters see on the actual ballot, is different from the language in the amendment and is vague and misleading.
Attorney Ron Meyer is representing the league in the lawsuit. He's also representing the state teachers union in a case against a Florida law that targets the Florida Education Association. Lynn Hatter spoke with Meyer about both lawsuits, starting with the case against Amendment 8. It's comprised of three proposals: term limits for school board members and mandatory civics education. But it's the language regarding school district oversight of public schools that's triggered the suit.
What's going on here with Amendment 8? Why is the League of Women Voters suing?
The lawsuit challenges the placement of Revision 8 on the general election ballot in November because we believe not only does it not clearly and unambiguously express the chief purpose of the amendment, but that it affirmatively was crafted in a way to mislead voters. They put bright, sparkly things around the meat of this issue. People seem to like term limits, so that's packaged in here. Who could be against teaching civic education, which, by the way, we already do? So they put that in there. But there's lots of people who would be opposed to removing the elected school board in their district from controlling the public schools that would be established by someone. And this amendment doesn't say who that someone would be.
So how could Amendment 8 do that? And what exactly does it say about who can and can't authorize charter schools and how that process works?
What it says is that the amendment maintains a school board's duties to public schools it establishes, but permits the state to operate, control, and supervise public schools not established by the school board. That's what the ballot summary says. But in fact, that's not what the amendment says. It just simply says that the school board won't oversee schools that it doesn't establish. Who can then establish schools? Well, that's the $64,000 question.
Now, you're also representing the Florida Education Association, a state teachers union, and they're suing to block a new law that says, in part, that local unions have to have 50% of eligible members paying dues or they risk being shut down. When that lawsuit was announced last week, incoming House Speaker Jose Oliva and incoming Senate President Bill Galvano were down at the Sunshine State Summit, and they were asked about it. And Oliva said basically that if they're mad about this, then they're going to have many more reasons to file more lawsuits over the next few years. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think, first of all, with all due respect to the incoming speaker and the incoming president, both of whom I admire and have a lot of respect for, they ought to update their talking points and look at the lawsuit that was filed. The lawsuit that was filed against House Bill 7055 was very narrow in focus. It challenges the penalty, if you will, that was imposed by Speaker Corcoran upon teacher unions and only teacher unions. That's what the lawsuit was aimed at. And yet I hear their comments about, oh, we support choice, and, you know, if they don't like the choice that's in the law now, just hold on. This lawsuit against 7055 was not against choice. It was against impairment of a constitutional right of public employees who are employed as teachers to effectively collective bargain. So for them to say that, it tells me that they got some speaking points without really having looked at and understood the lawsuit. And so we'll just do our best.
Mr. Meyer, thank you for taking the time out to speak with me today. I really appreciate it.
Lynn, I so admire your work, and I'm pleased to have an opportunity to talk to you.
Florida Public Radio's Lynn Hatter speaking with League of Women Voters attorney Ron Meyer. Still to come on Capitol Report, we'll get the latest Florida reactions on the recent U.S. Supreme Court nominee and if his nomination has any impact on the state.
Justice Kennedy's replacement must be a fair-minded constitutionalist. We simply cannot let President Trump take over the Supreme Court for the next 40 years with a rubber-stamp justice like Brett Kavanaugh.
Once again, stinky, slimy algae is overtaking Lake Okeechobee. Is a reservoir the answer?
Now, the question is, and it's a good question by you, and I think it's one that even scientists would have as well, is it a case of you're just moving the problem to a different area?
And is there any way to tell what the world looked like a billion years ago? A Florida researcher says she knows because of teeny tiny molecules found in what used to be crude oil.
These compounds are the skeletons of the animals that were there a billion years ago.
President Trump's U.S. Supreme Court nominee is already causing partisan divides among Republicans and Democrats. As Sasha Cordner reports, that fight is also making its way to the Sunshine State.
When U.S. Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy retired last month, it set off a storm. A Ronald Reagan appointee, he was known as the swing vote, at times voting with liberal or conservative justices. Now that Trump has picked Brett Kavanaugh as Kennedy's replacement, some aren't too happy with that choice.
We believe that Justice Kennedy's replacement must be a fair-minded constitutionalist who values equality and justice for all people, not just the wealthy and the powerful.
That's Ray Seaman with Progress Florida's Why Courts Matter Coalition.
President Trump's nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to a lifetime appointment on the Supreme Court should concern every single Floridian. No matter what your biggest issue is, whether you care about access to health care, reproductive rights, voting rights, protecting our environment, LGBT equality, or criminal justice reform, the fate of all of these issues hang in the balance. We simply cannot let President Trump take over the Supreme Court for the next 40 years with a rubber-stamp justice like Brett Kavanaugh.
Since his nomination, Kavanaugh has drawn criticism from liberal-leaning groups for some of his past stances as an appeals court judge. For example, he was in the minority when the appeals court decided last year to allow an undocumented immigrant in custody to seek an abortion. It's opinions like that that scare abortion rights activists, especially since President Trump vowed during a 2016 presidential debate to overturn Roe v. Wade, a Supreme Court decision 40 years ago allowing women to have access to abortions across the U.S.
Do you want to see the court overturn Roe v.
Wade? Well, if we put another two or perhaps three justices on, that's really what's going to be, that will happen. And that'll happen automatically, in my opinion, because I am putting pro-life justices on the court. I will say this, it will go back to the states, and the states will then make a determination.
Women across this country deserve access to safe and legal abortion, and we're going to oppose any nominee who's predetermined on this issue.
That's Missy Wesolowski, the statewide director of Florida Alliance of Planned Parenthood Affiliates. She's protested against Republican-led efforts in the Florida legislature to put abortion restrictions in place, and some have even faced court challenges. In a recent protest at the state capitol, she and other progressive groups called Roe v. Wade the law of the land and should not be overturned. But some in the conservative camp don't see that happening, even if Kavanaugh is put in place. North Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz is one of them. Still, he didn't rule out the possibility that there could be rulings supported by pro-life advocates.
Some of the pro-life initiatives that we've seen in state legislatures, for example, the pain-capable legislation, the heartbeat legislation, that the constitutional validity of those state-based actions could ripen before the court and could receive more favorable treatment, bring our country more pro-life position, but that wouldn't necessarily have to fundamentally alter the holding in Roe.
Still, whether Kavanaugh actually will get the role remains to be seen. He first has to get U.S. Senate approval, and it's unclear if he'll have enough votes. Since it's an election year, Republicans have set their sights on Florida's U.S. Democratic Senator Bill Nelson and whether he'll sign off on Kavanaugh. And while Florida's Republican Party Chairman Blaise Angoli acknowledges there are pro-choice Republicans, he says it would galvanize the base if Nelson does not vote to seat Kavanaugh based on his abortion-related stances.
If you had a bunch of people, Democrats, Senate Democrats, Bill Nelson coming out and saying that they did not want to confirm Judge Kavanaugh just based upon that issue, that would definitely motivate a big portion of the base.
As for Senator Nelson, he hasn't really said whether he'll agree to confirm Kavanaugh, only stating he'll make his decision after meeting with Trump's U.S. Supreme Court pick. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Images of bright green water caused by harmful algae blooms have taken center stage among ecological and political conversations in Florida. This week, the federal government approved more than $1.5 billion in funding to build a reservoir that takes overflow from Lake Okeechobee elsewhere in an effort to mitigate the algae's effects. Ryan Daly recently spoke with Florida Atlantic University's interim director of the Harbor Branch Oceanic Institute, Dr. Jim Sullivan, to talk algae and what the reservoir stands to do to help.
Is this current, you know, algal bloom season, how does it stack up against others you've seen in the past? And much is being made of it right now in the news, but for someone who's kind of entrenched in it all the time and keeps your eye on it, you know, how do you kind of rank the severity of this?
There are other places in the United States in particular that have recurrent harmful algal blooms every year. Lake Erie is a pretty well-known one nationally. Every summer they have blooms of Microcystis, which is the same freshwater algae that's harmful that grows in Lake Okeechobee. They've been dealing with that for over a decade now. The same algae also grows out in the estuaries feeding into San Francisco Bay. So they have to deal with it there too. I will say, having studied harmful algal blooms around the country in different areas, I personally believe Florida is one of the more impacted states in the United States just for the variety and the length of time that blooms just persist here. If you look at Florida as a whole, on the West Coast, we have what's called Florida red tide, which is Karenia brevis blooms that are pretty recurrent, and I understand there's a pretty bad one this year. In Lake Okeechobee, we have the Microcystis blue-green algae harmful algal bloom that it pretty much occurs every summer, some years worse than others. This year appears to be another bad year.
And I'm sure you may have seen almost $1.5 billion project has been approved at the federal level to build a giant reservoir to deal with overflow from Lake Okeechobee. So So scientifically, what is that doing? Are you trying to sort of dilute that water out by sending it elsewhere? Like what's happening that is beneficial there? That would be my question when I read things like that.
Well, I mean, it's a good question. Obviously back in, before the 1940s, when Lake Okeechobee, before the Corps of Engineers made canals that go east-west into the St. Lucie Estuary and the Caloosahatchee, the water would naturally run south. So, and go down into the Everglades and feed the Everglades. Now, they did the two canals going east-west. When the lake water gets high, they obviously have to discharge water, and that's exactly what they do. Now, if you start sending water south into holding ponds or holding reservoirs, you're at least going to alleviate the problem going east to the east and west coasts. I mean, because you're just not going to be discharging any large amount of water that way. Now, the question is, and it's a good question by you, and I think it's one that even scientists would have as well, is it a case of you're just moving the problem to a different area, or are you actually mitigating the problem? You know, will this actually work towards letting the blooms hold in a retention area and trying to clean up that water through some way before it's discharged south? Eventually, the water that goes south, it will go into the Everglades. That algae will still be there. It may do damage to the, the ecological systems in the Everglades. It's still toxic to animals, not just people. And that water could eventually get down into Florida Bay. I don't know if we know enough about the hydrology of the system to know what the impact of sending most of the water south, what that'll eventually have. It will certainly alleviate the problems on both the east and west coast, but we probably would need a little bit more science to understand if the water eventually is discharged fully to the south, what are the impacts to the ecology of the Everglades system and Florida Bay potentially.
That was Dr. Jim Sullivan, interim director of Florida Atlantic University's Harbor Branch Oceanic Institute, speaking with Florida Public Radio's Ryan Daly. Environmental activist Nathaniel Reed died this week at the age of 84. Anne Marie Welser reports on the legacy of his career.
Shortly after Reed's death, Florida Senator Bill Nelson took to the U.S. Senate floor to eulogize Reed's career.
Nat Reed leaves behind a long legacy as an environmental champion. He served as environmental advisor to Governor Claude Kirk beginning in 1967 And in 71, he became Assistant Secretary of the Interior for Fish, Wildlife, and National Parks under President Nixon. And he stayed in that position through the Gerald Ford presidency. Nat returned to Florida in 1977.
The Clean Water Act, the Everglades Restoration Plan, and the Endangered Species Act, all milestones in environmental protection, and all of which Nathaniel Reed helped pass. Everglades Foundation CEO Eric Eichenberg says the work changed the nation.
He dedicated his life to not just to Everglades protection, but environmental and conservation issues across the country, as far as defending redwoods in California to ensuring that additional lands were preserved in Alaska. I mean, Nathaniel Reed's legacy and fingerprints are all over this country.
The Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, Susan Glickman, describes Reed's time working in the Nixon administration and his role in helping establish the Environmental Protection Agency.
Even way back then, there was a big need. So he's been leading for such a long time and understood that sometimes you need to threaten legal action and other times you can solve a problem, you know, in sort of a friendlier way through relationships. And that was good at all that. And it's really a special person that understood the severity of issues sort of before they were part of the national attention.
Throughout his career, Reed served two presidents and six Florida governors. The Everglades Foundation's Eichenberg says Reed rose above partisan lines.
He never saw the environment or conservation as a partisan issue. The Everglades, Florida's environment, is not for Republicans only. It's not for Democrats only. And he worked with both parties to make sure that that folks were aware and eager to bring about positive change.
Florida Senate President Joe Negron issued a statement calling Reed a resolute force of nature, who devoted his life to protecting the environment of Florida and the United States. Reed advocated for wildlife preservation for over 60 years. He also mentored younger generations and emphasized the importance of education. Eichenberg says Reed will be most remembered for that particular characteristic.
At 84 years old, he was still meeting with high school students and graduate students, undergraduate students to really instill in them the need to engage in conservation and to ensure that we protect what we have, because if we lose it, we'll never get it back.
Reed not only taught students, but also colleagues, like the Clean Energy Alliance's Glickman.
He nurtured a lot of people and mentored a lot of people along the way, so we will pay him great respect by continuing his great work that is ever more needed now than ever.
And Eichenberg says when Reed faced challenges, he didn't shrink from them.
And he never gave up. He never gave up. And there's one thing to remember with the passing of Nathaniel Reed is not to give up, because that's what he did. He never gave up.
Reed died after a fishing accident in Quebec. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Anne Marie Welser.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, Amy McKenna is a chemist at the National High Magnetic Field Laboratory in Tallahassee. She also has a deep, dark secret. Amy McKenna is a porphyrin junkie.
We've seen these compounds in oil samples for the past 20 years, and I fell in love with this class of compounds back in 2009, and they're very interesting. I mean, it's the compounds in petroleum that are not degraded, so they're actually molecular fossils.
As a lead researcher on the chemistry of the millions of barrels of crude oil that poured into the Gulf of Mexico from 2010's Deepwater Horizon blowout, McKenna has seen lots of porphyrins. She was even tapped to give a talk on the subject at a scientific conference in New Hampshire. It was there that she met a kindred spirit.
A girl in the audience came up to me after my talk and was just like, I'm a porphyrin junkie too. I really loved your talk. I have this really cool sample. It's super old. you know, it's a billion years old. We know there's porphyrins in there. Can we work together?
That girl was Noor Guanelli, a paleobiochemist at Australian National University, and the sample of ancient marine shales she had came from West Africa. McKenna says the sample essentially provided a view back in time.
These compounds are the skeletons of the animals that were there a billion years ago. And that's 500 million years older than anything that they had on record to date.
McKenna and Guanelli became a research team, with Guanelli ultimately visiting the Mag Lab in Tallahassee to use that facility's ultra-advanced tools that were available no place else on Earth.
If you tried to do it on any other instrument, even another low-resolution mass spectrometer, all you're going to see is one hump. You can't actually see the compounds that are underneath it. So you have to have the only techniques that can do this are at the Mag Lab.
That ability to drill down so deep into the molecular makeup, says McKenna, allowed them to not only see the substance's structure, but also determine its color by comparisons with its more contemporary cousins.
These pigment molecules are the same color that we're finding in these porphyrins, which were pink when you pulled them. They're actually red, and then when you dilute them, it's pink. So you can take it to the next level. That's the oldest color that we know to date is pink.
McKenna says this finding was just part of a much more comprehensive study involving Australia National University and collaborators in Japan. They actually wrapped up the work a few years ago.
And then the paper was accepted into the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, which is a pretty prestigious journal, back at the end of May, but it was under embargo, so we couldn't talk about it. And then the minute the embargo got released, it was like blowing up CNN, The Guardian, Smithsonian. You know, it's pretty cool, and it's got big implications.
Beyond Amy McKenna suddenly going from scientist to superstar, she sees this research helping push the boundaries for researchers in all kinds of disciplines.
Everything from ecologists to oceanographers to chemical oceanographers to paleoclimatologists can now look back and say, okay, now we have some more information. We're pushing that time point always farther back to know how much do we really know about. Eventually, maybe one day we'll get all the way back to the beginning.
But in the meantime, thanks to McKenna and company, we now know you wouldn't need rose-colored glasses to see the world of 1.1 billion years back in a lovely shade of pink. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Brian Daly, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Anne-Marie Welser. Thanks also to our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FBR Cap Report. And please join us each week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at wfsu.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org. And from Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.